Welcome to Passing Mirrors CAM Podcast, Conversations on Aerodigestive Management. This episode of CAM features your host, Dr. Kristen King, and guest, Laura Brooks, continuing their conversation on research in clinical practice.
So as we've been talking about research and incorporating research into your daily clinical practice, we're going to talk with Laura Brooks. Laura Brooks is a speech-language pathologist at CHOA in Atlanta, and she has done quite a bit of research in her clinical practice, has a number of publications looking at different aspects of medical care with children. So I want to talk with her a little bit because she can give you the nuts and bolts of kind of getting started and how you can get that going with your daily clinical practice. So Laura, I want to welcome you. Before we get into the details, is there anything you want to share about yourself just in general or your background, your experiences as far as a speech language pathologist?
Sure. Thank you, Dr. King, for inviting me here. I'm honored to be a part of this. Yeah, I work at Children's Healthcare of Atlanta in the acute care ICUs. We have pediatric ICUs, trig vent ICUs, cardiac, neonatal, and then acute care floors. We do modifieds. We do lots of fees with ENT. I've been board certified in swallowing since 2012. And right about that time was when I developed and built our passing mirror valve program here. I joined the Global Tracheostomy Initiative, this team at our hospital with physicians, RTs, and I was the speech rep, and we kind of realized that we didn't have any kind of best practice protocol for who gets the passing mirror valve trial and kind of what our procedure is for that. So with their approval, kind of every meeting kind of going over, hey, this is what I'm thinking, and then people will give me feedback. We developed the best practice guideline for passing mirror valve use. We do passing mirror valves early. The earlier, the better. If you have a trach, you are on my radar, and I am asking the doctors if we can do a passing mirror valve trial. So, you know, we can get into that later.
Well, I really appreciate that. And I do know that you, well, first of all, your hospital has been honored with the Center of Excellence for passing mirror, and you definitely incorporate and do a lot with your patients as far as using the valve and getting in early with those kiddos. But I want to today focus a little more on just incorporating research, because you've done things in a number of different areas. And first, would you mind sharing a little bit about like what motivated you to even incorporate research and kind of how did you go about getting research into your clinical practice?
Well, this is kind of a funny story, and I don't know if you even know this, that this was my main motivator because it involves you. But back in 2017, when we came together and had the idea to put a proposal together for ASHA for a pediatric panel for an oral seminar, you know, I thought it would be kind of a slam dunk. I thought, wow, pediatric passing mirror valve use, this would be great for ASHA. And, you know, they're doing one in adults, and we haven't done one, I don't think, at least I hadn't been a part of one in peds. And it did not get accepted by ASHA. And the feedback that we got that was really motivating for me was that there wasn't enough research. They wanted us to present something research related with regard to pediatric passing mirror valve. And so that was super motivating for me. And I said, I thought to myself, well, I can get research. Like if research is what you want, I can give you research. And because, you know, we had, like I said, developed our passing mirror valve program here. We do it in line and with patients who are ventilator dependent and then patients who are not ventilator dependent. So I kind of use that to say, okay, that's my goal for next year. I want to present next year at ASHA on my research with passing mirror valve, and I did, which was super exciting. But that was my initial motivator. And what was great about a clinician who doesn't have a PhD, you know, you have a PhD, I'm sure you could basically run a study by yourself. But for me as a clinician, you know, I had to take certain steps.
First of all, I did not know that mm-hmm. story. And I think that's fabulous because that's funny. And that is something we hear a lot is that there's not enough research in pediatrics because they're considered a special patient population when it comes to research, it's a little bit more difficult sometimes to get approval and to get that research started. So I do want to share for those who are listening, while we're going to talk about what you've done with pediatrics, most of it will still apply even if they're in an adult patient population. You know, as far as just getting started and some of the things you need, there are a few things that are specialized because of it being pediatric, you know, just a few more hoops. But yeah, would you please share what you had to do to get started?
Sure. So I obviously first had to think, what is the question that we have? What am I encountering when I want to do a passive mirror valve trial on a patient? What am I encountering? You know, what is the pediatric ICU attending saying? What is the ENT resident saying? What is the pulmonologist saying? And what is the RT, the bedside RT saying? And so the biggest question that wasn't answered in the pediatric literature was, who's a candidate? You know, is there an age requirement? Do you have to have a certain kind of trach tube? Can you do it on the ventilator? And of course, oddly, you think that people would know that, but they don't. A lot of people don't. And so I'm saying that a lot to even physicians, you know, oh, it was actually invented by a gentleman who was ventilator dependent. So that was the biggest thing for me is just, you know, what's my question? And so I decided candidacy was the biggest question to answer. And so I met with one of our ENTs, April Landry, who does a lot of our reconstructions, and she's just amazing. She's one of the people, you know, always so pro passing mirror valve. And, you know, she's the one who initially said, let's get transtracheal pressure measurements so that we can ensure that the airway is patent. And so met with her, kind of came up with our idea. She's part of the study too. And then obviously got my manager's approval. My manager's amazing, Tricia Easley. And so I had her support, and she connected me to our director of research for nursing and allied health. So rehab, SLP is under that allied health. So met with Dr. Calamaro for to discuss, you know, my ideas. And then she connected me to Emory, who's our affiliate, Children's Healthcare Planning affiliate with Emory, with the statistician there and kind of the head of statistics there. So our IRB team was super helpful in encouraging me as a new clinician and my first time applying for IRB approval. And they kind of walked me through it and walked me through the steps, filled out the form. You know, we talked about the fact that we were doing a retrospective study. That was a big thing to consider is, do we want to do a study prospectively or do we want to do it retrospectively? Prospective studies are a little bit more challenging to get IRB approval for because especially if you're involving like something novel, like a new device or something that would be like a potential risk. And retrospective studies are basically going back and looking at your data of what you're just already doing in clinical practice. So for clinicians, it's pretty easy to do a retrospective study because all of that data that I'm looking at is all in my notes. So in my eval, I have the patient's age, the date they got their tracheotomy, the size of their tube, whether it's cuffed or cuffless, the ventilator settings, the indication for the trach, what their transtracheal pressure measurement was, what their settings were pre-post cuff deflation. So their stability, how long they wore it. So all of the data that I wanted to collect was already in my note. So that's really nice as a clinician to kind of think about like what would be an easy way to do a study. So that is how we got started.
Well, thank you for sharing that. So there's a few takeaways from that. One, you first kind of got your team together. It sounds, you know, because you found all the players, you know, who you needed in your department. You've got the biostatistician. You, of course, teamed up with the physician that you'd be working with. You mentioned your department manager. So you had a number of people who you pulled into the picture, you know, to work with you on it and got that started. And then after you had the team, and you mentioned the retrospective versus prospective study, and that's a really key point, I think, for people to think about. If they're trying to get started, as you mentioned, retrospective studies may be a little bit easier because you can look back at the data you already have. And it's a matter of having a question form mm-hmm. that you can then find the answers in your notes. And if you take mm-hmm. good clinical notes, make sure your notes have the data, you know, have the information that you might want to look at in the future. And I say that like someone might listening might go, well, I don't even have a question in my mind about research. So how would I know what to put in my notes for data that I might want to look at later? And my answer to that would be, you should be documenting everything you did with the patient. You know, like you said, like you were looking at patients with speaking valves and who had tracheostomies. So you were writing down things like the tracheostomy tube size, you know, what was the status of that patient at the time that you saw them? You mentioned transtracheal pressure measurements. It's a tool that you use regularly, I know, to look at airway patency, readiness for using a speaking valve. But keeping all that data, you know, keeping, I'm using data from a research standpoint, but as speech language pathologists, we collect data in our daily practice. So I'm going to shorten what I was saying. What you were saying was basically have that data, and then retrospectively, you can go back and look at it. Prospective, because you mentioned prospective, that's going forward. And like you said, might be a novel idea, and you're going to be collecting the data as you go. So your first study that you mentioned, you did the retrospective look at the notes, the patient notes, and collecting that data. How did you fit that into your full-time?
Well, one thing I definitely need to mention that I failed to mention is that the RTs were part of our team. So I could not dismiss that important point. I had to have RTs on my team. I had two that did all the passing ear valve trials with me. But how to fit it into the day, that's the challenge. I work 32 hours, but sometimes longer than that, Monday through Friday. I have twin seven-year-olds. And at the time of this study, they were probably three. So that's a little nuts. So, you know, just having that information already in the chart, you know, was obviously super helpful. Writing it up is probably the most time consuming. I didn't have funding. So if you apply for some kind of funding, you can kind of use that money to like kind of buy your time and use that to write. But I didn't have any funding for my project. And so all of the writing was on my own time. But the thing about being a clinician doing research is there's no pressure. I have zero pressure to do any publications or any kind of research study. So everything is completely coming from what I'm motivated by. And when you're motivated by something, you find time to do it. And it's important. And it's okay to carve out 5 hours of your Saturday morning, you know, working on something that you're passionate about. So that's what's fun about being a clinician, is that there's no pressure. There's no, I need to do a minimum amount every 5 years or something like that. You just kind of are drawn towards something that you're passionate about. And then that is motivating enough for you to take time out of your life outside of work to get it done.
And I agree. I think if you have passion for something, that definitely makes it easy to incorporate. And I think for people to do research, they probably should have a little interest and passion for answering the questions. Like I got started in research because I wanted to answer the question, why? You know, people would ask me, why do you do that? And I'd say, because we always have. And that's actually what got me started with research, was trying to answer the whys. That's what I think research does for us a lot. We also know, as speech language pathologists, people often say that we practice and are doing things in our practice that's not evidence-based. And you mentioned, and that kind of fits with what you said with your story, which I loved about what motivated you to start, because Asha, we submitted for that panel, was like, there's not enough research for it. We're doing it. So one thing I'd add, and what I'd like to talk with you about now, is that idea of prospective, because if someone is listening and they're saying, I'd love to get started with research, but they haven't really, depending on the notes they've been putting in the patient charts, depending on how their charts are organized and what they can access, if they feel like they don't have it retrospectively, let's talk a little bit about prospectively, even if it's not novel, like a novel medical device, even if it's candidacy for using a speaking valve, moving forward, they could start putting that information in their notes, you know, and then they would have that information to either, like, even if they don't go through IRB, say they haven't established a formal study, but if you're thinking, hey, I could do some research, I want to answer this question about, it could be something in fees or modifieds, it could be with speaking valve use, it could be with the effects of therapy. There's all kinds of things people could look at. If you plan what that question might be, start putting that information in the notes. And down the road, you could look at it retrospectively. You could have that data collection prospectively if it's an approved study.
No, I know. I think that the neat part about prospective, while it probably is a little more challenging, is that you can control it the way you want to control it. So like, we get a lot of information. And when you think about swallowing, we get a lot of our fundamentals, obviously, from Logoman and adult literature. So we ask these questions all the time as pediatric clinicians. Is that the case for peds? You know, chin down, cold temperature, you know, and then things like that. And so you can kind of say, oh, well, maybe that could be a study, like room temperature when you're doing modifieds versus cold temperature. And then that's your study and you control it the way you want to control it, or left versus right side lying. And, you know, with varying different anomalies like cardiac involvement, you know, vocal fold paralysis, stuff like that. So, you know, just all the things that we talk about with our peers, like, oh, I wonder if that's a thing. I wonder if that makes a difference. I wonder if left versus right is, you know, would make a difference in swallowing. So all those things that we're talking about at lunch or when we have a complex patient, that's your study, you know. And something that we haven't talked about too yet is like case studies. I've done three, and those are really nice, a nice way to get something that you have done with your patient that's different, that works, and that you want other people to benefit from and learn from. And so the three case studies that I published in Dysphagia were just that. They were very, very medically complex kids. The course was long and grueling and very multidisciplinary. But at some point there was something that I did as a clinician with this patient that worked, and that completely changed the course. And so those are really neat to, if you can't do a whole research project, or you want to baby step it, you know, putting that case study out there is also a nice way to kind of get started.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because yes, case studies, while they can be difficult and you have to find the right place to publish them, because not everybody will publish case studies can be a really nice way to, like you said, get some basic information out. Oftentimes you see case studies, like you said, on really medically complex patients that are requiring that we try new things or a little differently. Oftentimes that's the case. We can certainly learn from case studies, and they're a very valid form of research to share with people.
Yeah, the Dysphagia Journal calls it a clinical conundrum, which I love. And so they don't call it case studies. You know, you're not to put case study or case report or anything in the title, but the way that it's designed, which is so neat as a reader, is it sets up the patient's presentation and then the big clinical question. And then that question is answered. So it's a clinical conundrum. So I love the way that they have that design. And those are the three case studies that I've had published have been with Dysphagia under a clinical conundrum. You know, they have these parameters of how they want it. It's, you know, not too lengthy, one page for the kind of summary. So it's just short and sweet. And to me, just, you know, I learned so much by reading the clinical conundrums, and it's, they're kind of fun to write too.
That's a good thing for people to think about. I know you're sharing how they set theirs up, but if someone is wanting to publish something, thinking of the background, the history of the patient, you know, the setting up the patient themselves, then what was the question? And then the answer is a nice way to organize that. There are a lot of options for publication. So people need to be aware and kind of look, depending on what their question is, what their topic area is. There are more journals than I could ever name that publish in the field of medical speech pathology. And what I mean by that is it may not be a publication on medical speech pathology, but they'll take publications from speech language pathologists, nurses, RTs, allied health type of studies or case studies, or even articles that aren't a research study. There's a few journals that will publish more of a meta-analysis type, kind of that background and answering a question, systematic reviews. And so people don't have to necessarily be collecting the data. If they, depending on how they want to get started, they could do even doing the lit search, because for any study that you do, you have to do a literature search, be aware of what's already been done for your background. Well, if you find that it's not been done, and even if you find that maybe it's too challenging to establish in your facility, maybe it's something you're not actually going to be able to do, you still may be able to do that systematic analysis and or meta-analysis of all the literature. So there's a lot of different directions people could go at it. But back to getting it into clinical practice, you've mentioned case studies, you mentioned retrospective and prospective, but do you have any words of advice if someone's listening and they're like, I've always wanted to do this, but I'm never, you know, I just don't know if I could. I mean, do you have any like words of advice that you'd give people to think about?
Yeah, I actually, as part of the board certification in swallowing, you get paired with mentees. So I do that a lot with people who are kind of going through or considering getting board certified or whatever. And they're saying, you know, well, the hardest part for me is the piece where you need to be kind of showing that you're doing some kind of teaching outside of your facility. So publications or speaking at a course or something like that. So I always encourage people that I'm mentoring for that to start at your state organization and your and present there and then kind of meet people and network and then, you know, submit to ASHA, submit for a poster, submit, you know, anything to kind of just set your goal. Okay, what do I want to do this year? Okay, I want to, I would love to present at ASHA. I'd love to present at, you know, your state organization or anything like that. And then to set your goal and then apply. And you never know. I don't know if that's great advice or just, you know, have that aha moment when you're talking to your peers. And I don't know if you guys do journal clubs. We do journal clubs with our speech team, which is awesome. We do something really cool called Unsolved Mysteries, where we had called it UN, and the UN is in parentheses, solved mysteries. So we do modified, outpatient modified or inpatient or whatever. And there's this really complicated case. And then that's the topic for our team meeting or Unsolved Mysteries team meeting. And we kind of show the study, we go over the background, and then everyone kind of gives their 2 cents. The speech therapist, you know, that looks like, you know, myasthenia gravis. You know, we had a case recently where a patient was just so clearly, I mean, she just so clearly had myasthenia gravis, so clear to all of us, but not to the physicians. And so eventually she did end up getting that diagnosis and it became a solved mystery, but just stuff like that. That's a neat way of kind of, hey, I saw this during a modified today. It was super weird in the upper esophagus. It was narrowed. The doctor called it achalasia. You know, the ENT wants to do Botox first, you know, just, and then that's your idea. That's your interesting case. That's what we're all learning from. And just if, when you're doing stuff like that, and then you have that aha moment where like, hey, I could turn that into research. I could turn that into a case study. I could turn that into something and then just do it. I had no confidence that I could do it before. I didn't know if I could do a research study, but with people, with asking the right questions and people walking you through it, you know, it was not as daunting as you would think.
It all comes together and it can be done in daily clinical practice. You can do it retrospectively, what you've already been doing. You can do it prospectively and start just making sure that information is there. So if down the road you do research, you have the information back, you know, in your chart. Keeping organized notes can be beneficial and it can be done in any mm-hmm. setting. You're in acute care, and we talked about that at the beginning. You shared where you work, but this would work in an LTAC and a SNF and home health in the schools, in acute care. The idea of research and retrospective or prospective fits any patient population in any setting.
If you have Epic, if your system is Epic, the flow sheets that they have are very easy to pull data from. And if you're doing retrospective and you have what you need in a flow sheet, then great. If you don't, then maybe create a flow sheet for it so that you have that going forward. Like, hey, I might want to pull that data. Why don't I put all of this information in a flow sheet so that it's easy to pull from in the future or for a prospective study? I don't know if other big systems have that too, but Epic definitely does.
You mentioned one other thing. You mentioned lunchtime. And I would say that when y'all are talking around, you know, you're talking about your patients and sitting around the table. And that is something like, just if you're interested in research, be thinking like, what are some questions you might want to answer? And then look for it, like use Google Scholar, use PubMed, and see if anybody's done it before. because sometimes there's actually research and we don't even realize it, you know, in something that we have a question about. And sometimes you're going to find there's not. Even if you find it, doesn't mean you can't do it. It just helps you formulate what you're going to do.
If you do a search and you're like, oh, wow, I don't find that in my practice. You know, this paper says that infants have a cough response 40% of the time when they aspirate during modifieds. And I'm like, oh, they have it 1% of the time when I do my studies. And then, so like you said, same topic, different results, that we see that all the time when we're doing, doing our searches, and that, you know, you have one topic, and like transjugular pressure is a perfect example too. There are, you know, 5, 6, 7 different publications, mostly with adults. A lot of them say the same thing. Some of them are a little bit different, and that's helpful.
Well, thank you so much, Laura. I really appreciate you jumping on with me today and talking about research and how you've incorporated it into your practice. And I appreciate your time today.
All right. Thank you guys. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to this episode of CAM. We are happy to offer continuing education credit through ASHA for this podcast. To receive credit, please go to www.passymuir.com/podcast and click on the continuing education link under this episode. Then you will either create an account or log into your existing education portal account. Complete the quiz and course evaluation for your podcast episode. Your certificate will be available for download once completed.